Well, good evening and welcome to our second night of conversation on foreign policy. Last night we were treated to a very special lecture by Ambassador Crockett, and very exciting time to have somebody here of his stature. I had people emailing me yesterday and today saying, how did you manage to get him to come to Spokane? And it's great that he actually lives here now. So it's we're hoping that we can have him back now and then to give us his insights and perspectives on foreign policy in such a vital region of the country. It's always interesting to hear a person from the U.S. Foreign Service talk. I think his talk was very typical of the kinds of conversations you're likely to hear from a U.S. Foreign Service person. Very analytical, very diplomatic and careful, very thoughtful, and somebody who's capable of seeing the strengths and weaknesses of American foreign policy in a region that's very challenging, complex. And so I don't know about you, but I really appreciated all that we learned last night. We've got a wonderful panel tonight for Dean's Dialogue. And Dean's Dialogue is something we started several years ago. The effort was to have more critical dialogue and engagement on controversial intellectual issues on our campus. And we wanted to present differing perspectives and model as a faculty how we engage and disagree with one another, how we do so, and we can do so with great enthusiasm, but we also have a faculty here that manages to be respectful in the process of engaging in this debate. I don't know what kind of debate we'll have tonight, what kind of difference of opinion, but we have a great panel of experts tonight here with you. Dale Soden, to my right, is a professor of history and was the first professor I had U.S. foreign policy from back in, it was 18-something, 1885, when I was a student here. So, but we're really, it's actually kind of an honor, a big honor for me to sit here next to him, my professor from 1885, and that he's still capable of doing it. But he's a very accomplished historian, an author of a couple of books. His specialty, his area of expertise, is religion in the Northwest, but he's also very interested in foreign policy ideas and the ideas that have shaped this nation. And so he comes to this topic from the perspective of ideas and a real interest in how the United States engages the world. Next to him is Professor John Yoder, also professor of political science and a historian by training, background in African history, a specialist in the politics of Liberia in particular, and actually an expert who's called upon to oversee and supervise elections in a couple of different African countries. And it's quite an honor to have someone of his distinction and accomplishment on our faculty. So it's fun to embarrass him too. Another great colleague that we have here is Raja Tanas. Raja Tanas, you'll know, is a professor of sociology and also a very passionate, thoughtful analyst on matters related to the Middle East. In particular, his own experiences as a Palestinian academic and a Christian Palestinian have deepened my appreciation and understanding of the region. He's a gracious, humble, and very thoughtful person who always draws a ton of students to his Sociology of the Middle East class, and we know you're all here tonight, so props to you. All right, glad that you're here. And on the end of the table is Associate Professor Jennifer Holsinger. It's great to have Dr. Holsinger here with us. She also is an expert in the Arab American experience and has a book that we just celebrated the publication of about residential patterns of Arab Americans in the United States. And she's interested in the immigrant experience, and she'll be able to say something to us tonight about the way that Arab Americans are likely to perceive these issues and think about the kinds of foreign policy questions that we've been discussing over the past 24 hours. So we're very fortunate to have, when we come to an issue like this, to have the experts and speakers that are going to share with us tonight. Just a matter for format, we're going to give each person about 10 minutes to present their perspective on last night's lecture from the disciplinary angle that they come from. They'll give you enough background on the points that they want to give their perspective on. So if you weren't here for the conversation last night, you can still benefit from their comments. And then we'll have a few questions for them. I'll have a few questions for them, and then we'll open up the questions for you from the audience. I will be trying to provoke some different perspectives and disagreement, because I think that's interesting to see what happens. But one of the things I always appreciate about working with these colleagues is the respectful way in which they engage these issues. My name is Michael Leroy, and I'm the Vice President for Academic Affairs and Dean of the Faculty, and really happy that you could be here tonight. It's a special issue for me, too, because I'm a professor of political science and international relations, so whenever we get down to foreign policy and international affairs, this is always an exciting topic to me. So without further ado, I want to introduce Jenny, who's going to lead us off, and they're going to use the podium to my left to speak. So thank you, Jennifer.
Raiders of the Lost Ark, starring Harrison Ford. True Lies with Arnold Schwarzenegger. Rules of Engagement with Samuel Jackson. Back to the Future with Michael J. Fox. Jewel of the Nile with Michael Douglas. Never Say Never Again with Sean Connery. Road to Morocco with Bob Hope. I Cover the War with John Wayne. Raise your hand if you've ever seen at least one of these films that I listed. Wow. Raise your hand again if you've ever seen Aladdin, the Disney version with Robin Williams. Thank you. You can put your hands down. These films and 900 others researched by communications professor Jack Shaheen have one thing in common. They all portray Arabs in derogatory ways. Most all of us have seen at least some of these movies, and we can recite the stereotypes, whether you actually have or not. You may even be able to come up with examples to fit the three categories of Arab stereotypes. First, we have the saber-wielding, innately violent, bloodthirsty, nerve-gassing terrorist. The greedy, power-hungry, shifty-eyed, fabulously wealthy, big-nosed sheik. And the lecherous, oversexed, sheet-wearing pervert with a penchant for American women. And that's just the men. Just because we watch and sometimes enjoy these movies doesn't make us bad people, but it does make us part of a very complex system that involves the media, ourselves, and foreign policy. Ambassador Crocker gave us some good things to think about if you were here last night. I'm going to pick up on some of his ideas and delve into them a bit further. This will require us to understand two groups of people, our adversaries and ourselves. Tonight I'm going to put forth a case for us to consider, and this is my argument. Dehumanization at home is directly related to dehumanization abroad. Dehumanization at home is directly related to dehumanization abroad. What do I mean by that? Our perceptions of Arabs and Muslims, which are reflected in media representations, are interconnected with the war on terror. And I want to remind us that the war on terror doesn't just take place on foreign soil, but there are domestic policies involved as well. As Ambassador Crocker pointed out, we must consider history. So I'll begin there. And while my objective isn't to focus on Arab Americans, they give us a good place to start. So here we go. Contrary to what most people believe, Arabs have been coming to the U.S. for a long time. It's interesting, there's actually a claim that Arabic-speaking people discovered the New World and Columbus heard about it. There's not a lot to substantiate that, and it's not widely held, but it's interesting. We know for sure that they've been coming for at least a century, around the time that most of our European ancestors arrived. In fact, European and Arab immigrants had a lot in common at the beginning of the 20th century. They were poor, they were uneducated, they were Christian, they were very hardworking, and they faced a lot of discrimination when they got here. These waves from the Arab world and from Europe were cut off in the 1920s as a result of anti-immigrant sentiment, and they resumed about 40 years later, especially from the Arab world, not so much from Europe. During this hiatus, this 40-year hiatus, over several generations, these new immigrants assimilated. They learned the language, they saved money, they moved to the suburbs, and they became white Americans. I don't mean that they changed their skin color, but perceptions of them changed, and they became accepted. The differences between them and everyone else gradually grew less important over time, is what that means. This assimilation was so widespread that Arab Americans almost assimilated themselves out of existence. And then everything changed. In the 50s, 60s, and 70s, there were a number of factors at work. For one, there were important events taking place in the Middle East that involved our foreign policy, and I'm sure my colleagues will refer to some of those. During this time, an Arab identity was constructed. Before this time, there hadn't been Arabs as we understand them today. This was a political process. Along with events in the Middle East, there was renewed immigration to the U.S., not just from the 2 to 3 Arab countries where they'd come from before, but from the 22 countries that make up the Arab world today. There were also stereotypes on TV and in films, and they'd actually been there all along, as you may have inferred from my earlier list, but they became more prominent over these decades. All of these things made Arab ancestry very relevant, whether people liked it or not. These factors invoked ideas about human difference. It created an us and a them. Helped us define who Americans were and who they weren't. And Arab Americans became what we call othered. They became others. They didn't quite fit anymore into our society. That brings us to the tragic events of September 11. Notice that the story doesn't begin with September 11, and that is very important. Perceptions and public opinion had been cultivated prior to 9/11, and this shaped our responses to it. I remember very clearly that day, as I'm sure that you do as well, the almost indescribable feelings, the literal heartache that bordered on nausea, for me anyway, and the mix of fear, palpable fear. I think we all shared that and the world shared that, but we responded differently. I remember walking through a parking lot at the UW where I was a grad student. It had been a really unproductive day, and as I reached my car, two other students were leaving as well, and one said to the other, "Let's go beat on a taxi driver." It was our lack of knowledge about Arabs and Middle Easterners and Muslims and Pakistanis and Afghans. Sorry. And in the case of these two students, about Sikhs and Indians as well, and others that made it relatively easy for the administration at the time to garner support for policies that would treat these populations as monolithic groups. They are all responsible. They all must be punished. In other words, our wars were possible because we had already been taught that these groups were less than human. Sorry. Stereotyping and scapegoating is only effective in combination with a lack of exposure. If people had the experience of knowing who Arabs are, the response probably would have been different. Surveys show us that many Americans conflate Arab and Muslim and Middle Easterner. That means that they use these terms interchangeably and they don't see a distinction between them, when in fact they're not synonymous. And when we do learn about Islam or the Middle East, it's often through a filter, an ethnocentric worldview, so that we misunderstand their beliefs and their rituals and their cultural norms. This is evident in the fact that there are people who believed there to be a connection between Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden. In my personal opinion, ignorance isn't the culprit per se. When we fear knowledge because we might think it's contaminating, when we're apathetic to learning, when we rely on what we know is biased media, then yes, I think we're guilty. And I am guilty. I have been in the past of all these things. But when we admit our ignorance, when we ask questions, when we seek out new knowledge, when we think critically about the information we're consuming, then there's hope for peace. And for that reason, like Ambassador Crocker, I commend you for being here, for choosing this route, for being open to dialogue. No matter what opinion you bring to the table, this is our hope. My last comment, if you are looking for a new perspective on foreign policy, I have a suggestion. There will be about 50 people arriving at Spokane International Airport next month. They will come from Iraq, and they will be refugees who have lost their homes and probably much more. They will join 50 people who came this month and 50 people who came last month, and they will be joined by 50 people who will come the next month and 50 people who will come the month after that. They will join actually the fastest growing refugee group in Spokane. And they will face very difficult strategies as they start a new life. Even though many of them actually helped the U.S. military back in Iraq, they will face wait staff here in our city that will refuse to serve them. They will be called names at the gas station, and their loyalty will be questioned. If you're interested, I would contact World Relief or Global Neighborhood and ask them how you can help. Thanks.
Can you hear me? Yeah, good. Well, I would like to preface talking about my position on the Middle East foreign policy by stating that this topic is very, very, very difficult for me to talk about. And that is for the following reasons. First of all, it's really our foreign policy, and it's our national interests that are at stake here. A second reason I find it difficult to talk about this subject is that the prevailing environments in the U.S. at the moment, and those environments do not really allow us to have a frank discourse on this topic. For example, at the moment, we are involved in three wars, one in Iraq, one in Afghanistan, and the war on terror. We are a very tired nation at the moment. We are divided. In fact, last Monday, the CNN poll showed that more than one half of us in America today are against sending any more troops to Afghanistan. Our soldiers are still in harm's way, and our economy is in shambles. Also, another environment is that we are getting more and more involved in another country called Pakistan. Pakistan is a Muslim country, is the only Muslim country that has nuclear warheads, and Al-Qaeda is getting involved there too, and we are afraid that Al-Qaeda may have one day access to those nuclear warheads. And there's also the possibility of another war. We're talking about it, we've been talking about it, the war against Iran, sometime perhaps in the near future. Also, this is a difficult topic because of our special relationship and unconditional support of a country in the Middle East called Israel. And finally, it seems to me that perception, our perception of the Middle East seems to be more important to us than does reality in the Middle East. Last night, Ambassador Crocker, he declared without hesitation that as a nation, we are geographically and historically challenged. That means we are handicapped. He tried to be diplomatic in that sense. I could not agree more with him on his observation. What I would like to do next is, first of all, to give us a very brief background about the beginning of our involvement in the Middle East. Then I will identify the foundations for our foreign policy in the Middle East. And finally, I'll make one or two comments about Ambassador Crocker's address last night. It's very important for us to understand that we are recent comers to the Middle East. That's very important for us to understand. Besides some trade and some missionary work, America had absolutely nothing to do with the Middle East prior to the Second World War. Our involvement in the Middle East began with President FDR when he met with Ibn Saud, the founder of Saudi Arabia, on the USS Quincy in the lake of the lake in Suez Canal. That was back on February 12, 1945. That is the very beginning of our involvement in the Middle East, February 12, 1945. Only 5 years earlier than that date, when aides to President FDR suggested that the U.S. should develop some influence in the Arabian Peninsula, FDR wrote in a White House memo, "Tell the British that I hope they can take care of the King of Saudi Arabia. This is a little far afield for us." When the Second World War was over, it was a different world. For example, European Jews who were haunted by the horrors of Nazi Germany were emigrating in large numbers to the Arab country of Palestine. Standard Oil of California outbid the British for oil exploration in the Arabian Peninsula, and the commercial production of oil officially began in 1947. The British and the French empires, who dominated much of the Middle East since the end of the First World War, were in their early stages of decline. And finally, the United States emerged as the new superpower. Europe was the past. America became the future. So in November 1947, the United States government was instrumental in pressuring the United Nations, the newly founded organization, to vote on the partition of the Arab state of Palestine into two states. One state was to remain Palestine. The other state was to be given to the European Jews for a homeland in Palestine. 4.5 months later, President Truman, personally, as a person, was instrumental in helping create the State of Israel in the heart of Palestine on May 15, 1948. When asked why he did this, he said, "I am sorry, gentlemen, but I have to account to hundreds of thousands of people who are anxious for the success of Zionism. I do not have hundreds of thousands of Arabs among my constituents." President Harry Truman. Based on these events, the factors that shaped our foreign policy in the Middle East that began officially since the end of the Second World War are the following. Number one is to have access to Middle East oil that was cheap and that was abundant in unbelievable quantities. Number two, our policy was based on protecting Israel at any cost, a country that we helped create in the Arab state of Palestine. And three, we see the role of the Zionist lobby in shaping our foreign policy in the Middle East since the end of the Second World War. Consider this. Israel, as a country, is the enemy of the Arabs. Of course, and the Arabs are the enemies of Israel. But oil is in the hands of the Arabs. So our policy, if we are to talk about our U.S. foreign policy, is resting on those two pillars. We want to have access to oil, and we want to support Israel. But these are very contradictory objectives. And we see, therefore, that our policy for the past 61 years has been a juggling act between having access to Arab oil on one hand and protecting the State of Israel on the other hand. This juggling act produced an incoherent policy that does not genuinely serve our national interests, does not genuinely serve peace in the Middle East, and does not genuinely serve world peace. Afghanistan, Iraq, the war on terror since 9/11 are merely the fruits of our policy rather than the factors that shape our current policy. Last night, Ambassador Crocker mentioned that we have learned several lessons from Iraq. But there was no mention of how these lessons would be incorporated in reshaping our policy in the region. I believe these lessons ought not to be ignored. Ambassador Crocker also said that we as a nation ought to have patience when it comes to dealing with the Middle Eastern countries. He talked about the importance of continuity in our policy. To me, that meant to continue the course in dealing with the Middle East region since the course began after World War II. But what if the course doesn't work? What if the course didn't work? Should we continue to pursue a policy that has not served us well during the past 61 years in the Middle East? A policy that yielded anti-Americanism in the Middle East, anti-Americanism in the Arab world, anti-Americanism in the Muslim world and beyond? You may recall that our mission at Whitworth University is to honor God, to follow Christ, and to serve humanity. I believe we are doing well in the honoring God and the following Christ parts of our mission. A lot is yet to be accomplished in the serving humanity part of our mission, and that is by not remaining historically, geographically, and I would like to add sociologically challenged when it comes to our dealings with the people of the Middle East. Thank you.
What I want to do for a few minutes is just review some of what I think are the major objectives of U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East since 9/11, and then I'll say a few words about whether I think they're succeeding or failing, and then move directly to Afghanistan and comment a little bit about Ambassador Crocker and what I think we ought to be doing there. When I think about the big picture for U.S. foreign policy, I think Raja has summarized parts of it well, but let me just add a couple of other things here. First, I think it's clear that we have attempted to prevent another major act of terrorism against the United States by pursuing an aggressive policy against Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, and we still attempt to find and, if possible, kill Osama bin Laden. The second objective has been to overthrow Saddam Hussein and try to establish a democratically elected regime with the hope of some kind of bandwagon effect in the Middle East where democracy would take increasing hold throughout the region. Thirdly, we have engaged a policy where we try to isolate the current regime in Iran and hope that more moderate elements will come to power. Fourthly, we are making an ongoing effort, this is where Raja addressed most of his comments, to create a two-state solution each for the Israeli and Palestinians to live in, with more moderate Palestinian leadership to be more influential in ultimately the two states that we want to create. And then finally, we are working to maintain positive relations with key states, I wouldn't call them allies, but key states, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Pakistan, for different reasons. Succeeding or failing? Well, I suppose you'd say, number one, the jury is still out. We have not had a major attack against the U.S. since 9/11. And one cannot be certain, however, that our policy has been the principal reason for preventing this attack. And obviously, Osama bin Laden is still alive. As far as the second objective, Saddam Hussein was obviously overthrown. And the long-term outlook, however, is uncertain and requires, again, a continued commitment. But the hope for momentum toward democracy in the region has been little in evidence. Thirdly, the isolation of Iran. Ambassador Crocker talked about this as perhaps the most challenging issue for the Obama administration. Now, there has been a slight shift, it seems to me. There is more direct negotiation going on. In fact, what we're seeing even as recently as this week is the effort to achieve an agreement where low-grade uranium is being sent to Russia to be made into fuel rods instead of fissional material that could possibly be used for an atomic weapon. And we'll still obviously have to see how that turns out. Fourthly, the two-state solution. Quite simply, it's not going well. Fifthly, positive relations with key states such as Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Pakistan. I suppose one would say they have been reasonably successful. We remain challenged on all of those fronts, but in general, they're probably more on the plus side than on the negative side. Now let me turn to Afghanistan, and I do this largely through the lens of what I primarily teach each year, and that is the history of the Vietnam War. In general, it's a long discussion about Vietnam, whether it was a necessary, unnecessary war, but I think it's evident that it was the wrong war at the wrong time, and it was unnecessary for the accomplishment of our larger objectives in the Cold War. But I think Afghanistan is different, and this is the reason why. In 2007, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Michael Mullen, told the Congress, he said, "In Iraq, we do what we must. In Afghanistan, we do what we can." Now, with the decrease in violence in Iraq and a plan for the phased withdrawal going forward, our attention has obviously returned to Afghanistan. Where we once thought that the Taliban had been defeated, 2002, they have regrouped and are making a serious effort to bring down the current Afghan government. Other elements of the Taliban are engaged in a serious war against the Pakistani government. It seems obvious that those analysts who have asserted that the United States is entering into an increasingly disordered world, one analyst said, an era of persistent, irregular warfare, is correct. What's happened is that U.S. conventional military superiority has pushed our enemies toward insurgency to achieve its objectives, and we see that in several parts of the world. Now, clearly, the big question for the United States and its NATO allies is, do we get in or do we get out? And again, as Ambassador Crocker indicated last night, it's probably not that simple. This week's lead article in The Economist made an argument that I think is compelling, and let me just summarize parts of that and a couple of other analysts who have done a lot more thinking about this than I have. But there are three reasons to stay engaged. Number one, the West has a security interest in preventing the region from slipping into greater conflict. Anarchy in Afghanistan, the restoration of the Taliban, would certainly create more chaos in Pakistan as well. And if you're following closely, you can see that the Pakistani government has now committed itself to a full-scale war against the Taliban in its own borders. Secondly, withdrawing from Afghanistan and allowing the Taliban to return would seemingly embolden Al-Qaeda around the world, and that is not a good thing. Thirdly, withdrawal would be a terrible betrayal of millions of Afghan people. Millions of refugees have returned, children going to school, women in the workforce. The Taliban was an unmitigated disaster in Afghanistan. And again, it would be horrible for them to return. But the strategy is not simply more boots on the ground for the purpose of engaging in more search and destroy operations, or a strategy inclined to use more air power to bomb the Taliban in their mountain strongholds into submission. The strategy is one not of becoming an occupying army, as sometimes we have done in the past, but a partner with the Afghan government, with the primary objective not of killing the enemy, but of protecting the civilian population. In general, that is what David Petraeus and General McChrystal have been articulating. General McChrystal has given a range of options to President Obama, and the administration is in the midst of currently considering them. One of those options is to increase by approximately 40,000 troops, the number that are there in Afghanistan, for primarily the purpose of protecting the civilian population and partnering with the Afghan government and its forces. This is the hard part. The U.S. military generally designed to inflict an overwhelming, disproportionate loss on the enemy. And it generally tends to equate victory with very few deaths. And quite frankly, so do we as the American public. The new counterinsurgency doctrine reverses the perceived immunity against casualties by relying on force, and instead it demands more manpower instead of firepower. Soldiers in Afghanistan must continue to get out among the people, build and staff joint security stations with Afghan security forces. It's the only way to disconnect the enemy from the civilians. Persistent presence, meaning living among the population in small groups, staying in villages overnight for months at a time, is the only way to disconnect the Taliban from civilians, and is again largely what didn't happen in the course of the Vietnam War. Every coalition decision, every operation should be guided by two questions. Does this further the legitimacy of the Afghan government? Right now, there are currently three components that are lacking. One, a credible, legitimate government. Continue to monitor and see how this election goes. Number two, resources to do the job effectively. And number three, a belief that America's president is behind this war. We are still haunted by the specter of the debacle of Vietnam, and many of the factors that led us into this war are present in Afghanistan: weak political leadership, warring political factions. But Afghanistan is not a proxy war in the same way that Vietnam was, namely a proxy North and South Vietnamese serving the United States, People's Republic of China. This is a different war. It's much different, and there's much more that's at stake in some respect here than even in Vietnam. So what I'm suggesting here is that we offer a credible effort against Taliban. That seems critical. We benchmark our policy on the stabilization of our government, protecting the civilian population, and building the Afghan forces. One analyst said, however, and this is the challenge, most of all, Mr. Obama needs to fight this war with conviction. His wobbles over the last month have done more to comfort his enemies and worry his allies than any recent losses on the ground. Only if he persuades his troops, his countrymen, and the Taliban that America is there for the long haul does he have a chance of turning this war around.
What? Not works? Okay. I want to talk about opportunities and challenges, which is the topic that we were given, and think about what are some of the opportunities we face in the area of foreign policy. And the flip side of that is, of course, what are the challenges? If you can overcome the challenges, you've obviously taken advantage of the opportunities. And I made a list of a number of things that I think are extremely important as we look at the Middle East, and these would be applicable, I think, any place in the world. And a lot of these things are things that were hinted at or talked about very directly by Ambassador Crocker when he was here last night. Also, if any of you are interested, he wrote a very, very good article in Newsweek that appeared about a month ago. It was about an 8-page essay that Ryan Crocker wrote on American foreign policy on the Middle East, reflecting his experiences, and also you get hints of his disagreements with the previous administration and where he thinks we ought to be going in the future. But let me just review the things that I think are important. The first thing that's important, and Ambassador Crocker talked about this, and a couple of years ago, a friend of his, Tim Carney, who was the ambassador to Sudan, was on campus and gave a number of talks and came to some of the classes. And Tim Carney said the same thing. We need to have a balance between what military people will call kinetics and negotiation or talk. Now, kinetics, if you're in physics, it means you throw something. And when you talk to somebody who thinks about military strategy, they talk about throwing things, dropping things, you know, generally with some kind of explosive attached on the other end. And Ambassador Carney and also Ambassador Crocker talk about the fact that too often, and this isn't the military so much, as often the civilian officials and the American public think there's a problem. Let's go in and drop a bomb. Let's go in and shoot somebody, and that will solve it. And that simply doesn't work. Over and over we hear, you can't end terrorists or terrorism just by killing more terrorists. You know, if our strategy in Afghanistan, if our strategy in Iraq is to end the situation there, clean it up, just by going in and killing the bad guys, it simply doesn't work. And as General McChrystal has pointed out, when he took over command in Afghanistan, every time you kill a civilian, you create a whole host of enemies. And there has to be a more balanced strategy than say, okay, what we need to do right now in Afghanistan is put in 40,000 more troops. End of story. That'll solve the situation. There has to be a strategy to win supporters. And that's going to take talk. That's going to take negotiation. And unfortunately, in the past, America, because we have that military tool that's unsurpassed in the world, tend to bring that out and think that's the one thing that we need. And I actually went back in my file and came across a talk I gave in October of 2002 before we invaded Iraq. And I looked at some of the things I said at that time, and I thought, you know, those are things I could say again. very much. And the thing I said at that time was, we're going to win this thing in Iraq. You know, it's a slam dunk. It's about as much of a contest as if you had UW playing Whitworth on the football field. I mean, there's no contest. Now, UW isn't doing so well anymore, and maybe it'd be a better contest if we got our running back. But the point I went on to make is, yes, we'll win the military battle, but there are going to be a lot of complicating factors that are going to come back and bite us and going to make this very difficult in the long run. One of the things I said was, we're going to be tempted to betray our values. And unfortunately, that certainly has been seen in Abu Ghraib and other places. It's going to be very difficult to build democracy. And I said that because of my experience in Africa. Democracy, good government, doesn't just spring up automatically if you rid the country of a dictator. You have a political culture that is there, that remains. And building democracy is a very, very difficult task. I was concerned that we'd weaken international institutions. International institutions and allies. Allies and institutions that we badly needed unless we were going to shoulder the whole burden by ourselves. I was worried that our actions in Iraq might encourage rogue states to arm themselves more aggressively, more robustly. And I thought, look at Iraq. They didn't have operational nuclear weapons. We were worried they might get them sometime. We went in preemptively. But North Korea had some things, and so we stayed back. What's the lesson, I thought, for Iran? Well, you better get nuclear weapons to prevent that from happening again. And finally, I was worried that invading Iraq would actually set democracy back around the world, that it would tarnish the reputation of America, make American ideals and democracy less appealing. And what I was saying then and what I'm saying now is, if you focus on kinetics, there are so many other things, so many other factors that will elude you, that will escape your vision. And those things need to be taken into account if there is going to be peace and stability. A second challenge and a second obstacle is that American foreign policy needs to have a more nuanced view, a deeper understanding of culture. And this is very related to what I was saying before. But if we're going to bring any kind of stability in Iraq, and I think we may have turned the corner there, although I'll be confident of that in 10 years, but there does seem to be a positive direction that, frankly, is happen maybe sooner than I thought it might. But if we're going to have any kind of satisfaction in Afghanistan, there's going to have to be a better understanding of culture, going to have to figure out how do you negotiate with the warlords, with the tribal groups, and so on. This cultural understanding is not needed if all you do is drop ordnance, and you drop that ordnance controlling a drone airplane while you're sitting in a building in Nevada. You don't really have to understand the culture. But that isn't going to peel off the Pashtun from the more radical elements of Al-Qaeda or the Taliban. It's not going to help you understand the social structures, the economic structures, the values, the fears, the needs of people that are going to have to be things we understand if we can come to some kind of accommodation in Afghanistan, in Iraq, and deal with Iran. I was interested last night, and I don't know that the person is here. I don't think so. There was an Iraqi individual here in the audience. In fact, he asked a question. He came up and talked to Ryan Crocker afterwards and basically said, not quite, well, almost this directly, we sure like you better than Paul Bremer. You know, we liked what you're doing. You understood the culture. You tried to reach out. You tried to be constructive. And certainly the change that Ambassador Crocker and David Petraeus and General McChrystal have talked about is we have to understand the local culture, the local situation. I'm reminded a couple of years ago I had a student come back who had spent time in Iran, time in Afghanistan. He had been deployed in Afghanistan as a U.S. soldier for a number of years, and he had taken some courses here before he left for Afghanistan. He came back to finish his degree. And he said, I talked to my commanding officer when I was in Afghanistan, and that would have been 3-4 years ago. And I said, we need to do more than just shoot people. And we have to think about building schools and reaching out to kids who don't have an education. And the commander said, oh, that's a bunch of silly academic stuff. You know, we're here to clean up the bad guys. And I think in retrospect, we can see that the commander was wrong. Another challenge we have is that we need allies. What we see in the current administration, and this was started in the Bush administration as they shifted away from sort of the Rumsfeld-Cheney policy, listening more to people like Colin Powell, who of course by that time had left, but Colin Powell, Condi Rice, other people in the administration, who said we need to have a more nuanced policy. We can't just focus on sort of a military mission. And we need allies. We can't neglect our allies in Europe. We can't offend them. We have to work with the Russians, other people. And in the end of the Bush administration, they were moving in that direction. And Ambassador Crocker was very, very complimentary about that and is pleased that the Obama administration is moving in the same direction. In the article he wrote in Newsweek, he had a very interesting comment. After 9/11, he went to Geneva, and he talked about this last night, to work with the Iranians. The Iranians indicated that they would be willing to work with the United States to cooperate in trying to identify terrorism and trying to, you know, stop this. The Iranians weren't particularly pleased about 9/11 either. And Crocker said the meetings were very cordial. Some of the Iranian diplomats had trained in the United States, and they remembered football games and so on. And he said, then Bush came out with his axis of evil speech. And he said that just stopped the negotiation. It stopped any progress that we had made. Another challenge and opportunity is that we need to recognize the interests of other players. That was very clear when Ryan Crocker was talking about Iran and Iran's pursuit of nuclear weapons. Now, I don't think Ambassador Crocker is happy that Iran is pursuing nuclear weapons. In fact, he said, that's going to be our biggest problem in the long run. And it's pretty clear he doesn't have an answer to that. But he looks at that and he says, I understand why Iran would pursue nuclear weapons. They see themselves as a big power. Big powers want to have a lot of power. And be very logical, they would want to have nuclear weapons. Now, Crocker is saying, I understand, I don't agree, but that's a better position than calling them devils or evil or something like that. And I think Michael wants me to stop, and I'll quit at that point. Thank you.
Such perceptive colleagues. Thank you. That's great. Well, got some questions that I'm going to try to ask to bring this together, and then we'll open up the questions to the floor. Great perspectives, all four of you, thank you, from your experience, from their disciplinary points of view, and you can see the skills and depth of knowledge that we have in our faculty here. I'm grateful for it. First question I want to ask relates to public opinion in the United States. Really what I want to be asking, in both of these countries, I don't know if you remember, that Secretary of State Colin Powell talked about the invasion of either of these countries, Iraq or Afghanistan. He had the pottery barn thesis that if you break it, you buy it. In other words, we better be careful about, and very much what Ambassador Crocker was saying yesterday, better be careful about what you decide to do because you could involve yourself in a very long-term kind of commitment. The U.S. now plans to pull combat troops out of Iraq in 2011. And one of the questions I have for you is, what about Afghanistan? Dr. Soden argued that staying there is essential. It's important for the security and safety of the population that's now beginning to feel some freedom and some freedom to express themselves, for women that can participate in civil society more fully, and that the preservation of that security is essential. And yet we see public opinion very evenly divided in the United States, almost 50-50 on this. So the question that I ask here is, how long should the U.S. presence remain? And what are the benchmarks that we should look for to feel satisfied that the U.S. presence can be diminished safely and in a way that ensures stability and security? And I'd be very interested in each of your responses to that question. How would you speak to the American people at this time about this issue?
Well, obviously, I think that the commitment needs to be strong. I don't know what exactly would be the litmus test or the time frame. I think that's always challenging one way or the other. There's a sense in which just an open-ended commitment, an eternal commitment, that doesn't seem to make sense to anyone. On the other hand, to say it's got to be a year or 2 years or... I think so much depends on the Afghan government and to some extent on the ability of us with the Afghan government to raise up a security force that can, in some sense, provide the security that right now the American forces are primarily and the NATO forces are primarily engaged in. But those are, you know, difficult and moving targets.
I'm divided on this. I'm not quite sure which way to go. On the one hand, I think we've gone into a country like Afghanistan. We've caused a lot of dislocation. It'd be sort of like you'd go into a neighborhood and take away the police or any kind of stable government. They'd just pull out. You have a responsibility to sort of provide security. And that might be. On the other hand, I'm tempted to agree with my conservative hero, George Will, who said, get out. We're not going to be able to manage that situation. We assume that by being there, we actually can fix things. I heard that during the Vietnam War. I was a student at that time. If we get out, it's going to be a disaster. It will be bad for American prestige. American power around the world will be seriously undermined. We eventually had to get out, and it really didn't hurt us very much. There are a lot of places in the world that have really bad governments. A lot of places where Al-Qaeda could probably go, and we don't try to go in and change their governments and do much about them. I think that probably we could monitor Al-Qaeda like we're doing now with good intelligence, and if there's a real Al-Qaeda threat, go after it without having to try to control large swaths of government in the Middle East and now in South Asia. And if you talk about mission creep, we've seen serious, serious mission creep over the last 10 years, 5 years, 6 years.
Well, I wish I have an answer for you. I don't. I have a descriptive answer, and that is Afghanistan is like an operating room where we got inside to operate on a patient. Table, cut up the tummy inside, and we said, wow, we cannot operate, and at the same time, we cannot put it back together. That's the situation we are in. And your hero was George Will, he said. Is that his name?
George Will. Yeah. I tend to agree with George Will and John. Seriously, I think the sooner we leave.
Oh, it's not working. Hello. Oh yeah, maybe I should. Okay. I'm sorry. I tend to agree with George Will and with what John said. The sooner we leave Afghanistan, the better for us and for the Afghanistani people. And the worse, well, it will be a very bad situation anyway, whether we leave tomorrow or whether we leave 20 years from now. It will be messy. It is messy. Yes, our prestige will be hurt for years to come. But I think our leaders should have thought of that before they got into Afghanistan. And Iraq is no different. I expect also Iraq to be a very messy situation once we leave.
Well, I'll take a stand and say, yes, we have an obligation. But there are many ways to preserve stability. The military is one, and perhaps that's necessary, but we need to supplement that with at least a better understanding of what makes a bad guy, and how social institutions in these societies have been damaged, how they have worked in the past, what role formal and informal social controls play and could play. So needs to be supplemented.
The only thing I'd say in response, particularly to John and Raja, is that I think the Afghan people are wanting, first of all, outside of the Taliban, want us to stay. They're tremendously fearful of a return of the Taliban. And the same thing, to a certain extent, is true in Iraq. Every time you start going down this path of, you know, of saying, should the United States get out sooner rather than later, there is a significant body of opinion that suggests that what's restraining a resumption of ethnic violence is U.S. presence. And so when both of you talk about it's better for the United States, I'm not necessarily shocked, but in the sense of saying it's not really totally about the United States. This is about a little bit of the Colin Powell analogy. Yes, we're in this now, and we have a responsibility to do the best we can at preserving, protecting, essentially, the security of both of these populations.
One of the topics that didn't come up last night was touched on in a very interesting article that I would commend to any of you that haven't seen it. In the Atlantic Monthly in October, Andrew Sullivan, who's a conservative writer and columnist, wrote an open letter to President George W. Bush in this issue of the Atlantic Monthly, asking the president to make a formal apology to the world community for allowing the U.S. government to torture citizens from Islamic countries. And I thought of this as Jennifer was describing the social construction of the Arab American identity and the Arab American image in the U.S. cultural view, because for the first time in U.S. history, a nation shaped by, in many many ways, Christian values, the value of the sanctity of the human being, sanctified, in fact, by matter of policy, allowed the torture. The legal torture of human beings. It's a powerful argument and a powerful letter that Andrew Sullivan has published. What I want to know from you is, should an apology be issued by the former president, and in what ways does this policy that is hard for Americans to speak of, damaging in the long run to American credibility and American ideals?
You know, the Arab culture I am a product of it. I came to America when I was 26 years and a half old. I understand it very well. You can torture a person in the Arab world. You can do whatever you want, how bad it is. But if you apologize, you start on a very brand new page. They forgive you. There's so much forgiveness there. If you apologize, especially if the apology is public. From their point of view, the president probably has to apologize. I agree with that writer, what he said. But what does it mean to us as a nation? What does it mean to us as a foreign policy? What does it mean perhaps to President Bush himself? I don't think, from my point of view, I think President Bush sincerely believed that he was right in everything that he has done under his presidency. He did not try to deceive anybody. He sincerely believed what he did. And that is probably an issue.
Well, it's an awfully difficult question, and I guess I would start by saying that I think torture is wrong. It's abhorrent. I think that it does really nothing but put our own soldiers in more harm's way, our own prisoners of war in harm's way. I totally subscribe to John McCain's objection to torture. I think when the way in which this country needs to publicly deal with it is a complicated question, and I don't really mean to say, I mean, on the one hand, I'm fine with saying that President Bush should apologize if he believes. I don't think anybody should apologize if they don't believe that what they did or authorized or whatever is wrong. I think that's something, now that he's out of the White House, that's his personal choice. That isn't something that we as a people can mandate for former presidents. I do think it's naive. I'm not sure what the implication of this, though, is. We engaged in torture in the Second World War. We engaged in torture in the Spanish-American War. This isn't the first time, and it won't be the last time, that torture is employed as a part of very dirty, ugly wars. It just won't be. It's human nature, and no amount to me. I mean, we can moderate it, we can be clear about its unacceptability, but it will continue to persist. Now, I don't think that excuses it. I don't think that necessarily means we should back away from very strong public pronouncements against it. But if the purpose is to solidify in the minds of people all over the world that we don't believe in torture, I think there are other ways of doing that, frankly.
I hear that kind of argument. I think, yeah, it would be good if the president apologized. I think it's about as likely as you'll see Bill Robinson say, I don't believe in the education of heart and mind anymore. I mean, it's not going to happen, so it's sort of a pointless discussion. How do we as Americans exert influence around the world? We are a major power. We are the big power in the world. Power means that you get other people to do things that they otherwise might not have done. They didn't think of it on their own and maybe even didn't want to do it. Well, the simple answer is throw your weight around. Compel other people. Force them to do what you want. Frighten them into doing what you want. That's one way. The only problem with that, as soon as you sort of ease up on the force, then they go in a different direction. A better way, a longer-term way, a more stable way, is to have people follow you because they admire, because they are influenced by your values. And The problem with torture, of course, is it undermines our values. It makes the American system of democracy, the American cultural values of gender equality and all the other values that we say we treasure, it makes those seem hypocritical or less appealing. And so in the long run, we really undermine ourselves now. I suppose it'd be okay if Bush would apologize. In a sense, Obama, in his speech to the Arab world in Cairo, said, we want to be more engaging. We want to be more a part of the more respectful in our conversation. That's probably about as far as you're going to go in terms of any kind of national recognition that we're on a different course.
I'll suggest that it doesn't have to be Bush who apologizes. Our government has apologized before different presidents, after which the action has taken place. Maybe. The Tuskegee research, it took a couple of decades. It's symbolic, and symbolism is very powerful. That'll please some people, but for others it won't be enough. If there's a chance, it decreases our likelihood of torture in the future, whether it's inevitable or not, then it's at least worth a try.
Open up the floor to your questions, give you a chance to engage our panelists, and throw out some of those issues that you might be wondering about that you'd like them to address. So Professor Lindy Scott is over here with the microphone. He's going to run around up and down the stairs to answer your questions.
Thanks. I'd just like to hear some comments about Saudi Arabia. It kind of baffles me to notice the lack of discussion, not just tonight. I mean, there's obviously a lot to go over, but in the media as well. You know, all the things we're talking about in the Middle East, they all tie into Saudi Arabia. I mean, what, 90% of the 9/11 hijackers were from Saudi Arabia. The country does not seem to be any fan of democracy itself. Traditionally, it's been one of the largest supporters of the Taliban in Afghanistan, both through arms and finances. And it's probably one of the most blatant human rights abusers in the world right now. And yet, there's really no discussion about it in the news. And both this administration and the previous administration have had nothing but really cordial relations with the monarchy there, and it just seems to be out of public focus altogether. And rather than, you know, addressing those things, we've put together, you know, on rather spurious evidence, obviously an invasion to Iraq that was somehow tied with 9/11, even though, you know, obviously that proved to be rather weak. So I'd just like to hear some discussion on that.
I'll say briefly, I think you're right. It's a festering problem for all the obvious things that you said. It's related to what Raja said about oil being critical. They're a major supplier of oil, and we obviously even have military installations there. So it's a problem. I think Egypt is a problem, and for some of the same reasons, there are things that are festering, percolating. I'm not sure that. I guess all I'd say is the reason it's not being discussed much is because I don't think there are any easy answers.
Right, you are right. We don't talk about Saudi Arabia much. Saudi is our friend. And we should distinguish between the ruling classes and the masses. The ruling classes depend on us for their protection. and they listen to us when we need stabilization of the oil market, for example. One half of the Saudi society today does not have the right to drive a car. These are women. Women in Saudi Arabia don't even have the privilege or the right to drive a car. So there are so many abuses there. But we don't feel free to talk about Saudi Arabia because the ruling classes are our friends. By the way, they own, Saudi Arabia alone has more than 25%, maybe 26% of the known oil reserves in the world today. So more than one quarter of oil is in the hands of one king.
To echo what Raja is saying, that's absolutely right, and it's also tied into Al-Qaeda and terrorism. The thing that Al-Qaeda and certainly Osama bin Laden is so disgusted with is that there is a regime like that that is oppressive, and it's supported by the American military presence and American diplomatic support. So that part of the equation I'm very concerned about. The other side of the equation, though, there's something that I think is going on that's a pretty good thing, and that is our attitude toward places like Saudi Arabia and Egypt is they will eventually evolve, and give them time. Let's not go in and try to change them. That's their internal issue, and they'll struggle with this, and eventually it'll turn out the way it'll turn out. And that's quite different than the way we approach places like Iraq. We've got to go in. By the way, things do change in Saudi Arabia. Yes, women are not allowed to drive, but women do drive in Saudi Arabia. When a family goes on vacation and they get outside of Riyadh, the woman will drive.
We'll drive only early in the morning before other cars are with you.
I think that actually Saudi Arabia shows up a little bit more than maybe you're hinting at, and maybe I watch too many Hollywood blockbusters and too many PBS shows, but it shows up more than Tunisia does and some other Middle Eastern countries. We don't think critically about Saudi Arabia. I think you're right on about that.
Getting back to piggybacking on America, the U.S., and how we present ourselves or how we engage the people in the Middle East, you know, our image and everything is so important. You know, I get so sick of why can't we, you know, everybody, we have Christian leaders and can't they recognize the strength of humility? You know, humility is such a principle that's held in such high regard, and it means so much. And I think that the more we can engage the people in the Middle East on a compassionate, human, spiritual level, you know, that's the only way we can lead by attraction or promotion or, you know, and I mean, we just keep breeding hate. And with the way we might is right is just, it's over, you know. And why can't we recognize that the strength of an apology and humility and admitting that we were wrong? It just seems like we can't do that. Why is it so hard for our leaders to see that?
Answer to that, I doubt that you do either, but I sometimes think, what's it going to look like 100 years from now or 200 years from now? People will look back and say, you have these three religions, Christianity, Judaism, Islam, all believe in the same God, all go back to the same father, Abraham, all talk about peace and justice, and look what they do to each other. It makes no sense.
I guess the only thing I'd say is that I do think that President Obama has presented a different image. The speech at Cairo that's already been mentioned. There are lots of symbolic things, some of them small, some of them large. Jenny mentioned the importance of symbolism, and I think that that's what's going on right now. I mean, it's too early to say what kind of impact or how long-lasting this is, but I don't think it's right to paint everybody with the same swath right now.
Well, politics, as John said, is all about power. It's not about humility. And if you remember, exactly 1 month after 9/11, specifically on October 11, 2001, a prince from Saudi Arabia by the name of Bin al-Walid, he came to New York. And he wrote a check in the amount of $10 million. He gave it to Mayor Giuliani. And he said to him, here is a small amount of money for the families of New York. I feel terribly sorry for what has happened. But by the way, the Bin al-Walid continued to say, this could be an opportunity for America to look inwardly, to look into your foreign policy in dealing with Palestine and Israel. Anyone remembers that story? John, do you remember that story? You know what was the response from Mayor Giuliani? Somebody's nodding his head. What did he say? Get back. Get out of here. Take your check and get out of here. What you have just said, Giuliani said to the prince, is the problem behind 9/11. So what does this tell me about that? Well, I'm not sure if Giuliani at the time, he represented America. But it tells me that there was no humility, there was no openness, there was no willingness to listen to the other, to the narrative of the other. We are right, you're wrong, get out of here. Perhaps that was the embodiment of arrogance, I guess. I'm sorry to say that.
I'll respond and point out that Ambassador Crocker began talking about the principles that America was built upon. And he didn't say what those principles were, but I wouldn't probably put humility in the list. And so I know that we struggle with that. At the same time, one of my main points was that we shouldn't generalize to other populations around the world. We shouldn't generalize to our society as well. And there are definitely people who understand the power of humility in this country.
This may have been addressed last night, but I was going to go ahead and ask this question. Since it would be, you know, it looks like by what we've talked about tonight that it would be extremely irresponsible for the U.S. to exit these countries because we have destabilized them in so many ways and on so many levels. Would it be more responsible for us to create, call it something else? I like the way it was said that it would be good for us to build relationship and to actually live in neighborhoods and try to find out and weed out some of the Taliban that way. Would it be better of us to call it something else, maybe not social reform, because they wouldn't like the idea of us saying you now need social reform, but instead of sending in the military as a dominant presence, should we send in diplomats, teachers, doctors, nurses, social workers, construction workers, economists? Would it be better for us to kind of dress it up and be sincere about it, throw in some compassion with that, possibly some humility, save face, you know, in our world level, and go in there and help them restabilize their country? Can it be done? And also when us sending this aid package that was just passed to Pakistan, we said, you can have it if you do this, this, and this. So can we help them do that? Will they allow us to come in there and bring people over to help physically even rebuild?
If you add sociologists to the list, I would say yes.
Yeah, I think that's what a lot of people are suggesting. I think I'm listening to John. John and I agree. John tried to contrast just sending in the military versus essentially people who are working with people in neighborhoods and essentially providing security and really developing that way. And that's what really Petraeus and McChrystal are arguing for. They're not arguing for, you know, just bombing the Taliban back to the Stone Age. And so I think the challenge is just the commitment of what it takes to do and accomplish what you're suggesting.
Okay, one more question.
Okay, here's a tricky one, and I'm not sure. Either way, the oil reserves are going to be gone or irrelevant in about 20 to 30 years. So the question is, politically, what happens then, especially with Saudi Arabia? And do we simply lose interest or what?
I don't know. I mean, again, you take oil out of the equation, I think things will be different. It's such a complicated region, and our interests seem to be more complicated every year. So to predict, I think, is difficult.
You know, I don't think if we don't act on solving the Palestinian-Israeli conflict in a manner that is just to both parties, I think the 30 years from now, the situation will be worse than it is today in the Arab world, in the Muslim world, in the Middle East. Just to give an example, you may have heard about the Goldstone report about the Gaza massacre. And the Goldstone, he's a judge from South Africa, highly honored and respected at the national and international level, unbiased. And he accused Israel of committing war crimes in January of this year, past December, and early this year in January. He also made reference to Hamas, that Hamas also committed war crimes against Israeli civilians. And he demanded from both groups to do an investigation within 6 months, and if they don't submit a report, that both Israel and Hamas will have to go to the International Court of Justice at The Hague. About 4 or 5 days ago, the United Nations has supported the Goldstone report, the Human Rights Commission supported the report, and it passed, so Israel has to face, and Hamas has to face, the Goldstone report. But if you look at who of the countries that opposed what the Human Rights Commission said, we were one. So here the United States of America agreed with Israel that the Goldstone report is biased. And on this note, if you look at the United Nations experience in this conflict, there were more than 70 UN resolutions issued against Israel, and to this very moment, none of them, zero of those resolutions, has been implemented. And the reason behind that is because of our foreign policy. So America has a role to play, a significant role to play. America is feared in the Middle East. America is loved in the Middle East. America is respected, whether
we are aware of that or not. So we have a big responsibility. U.S. foreign policy in this regard is pivotal in helping solve that conflict. Once that conflict is resolved, you'll be amazed to see, for example, that perhaps more than 90% of what we call international terrorism will disappear overnight.
I'm going to wrap this up. And if you read the newspapers, and actually I've been worrying a lot about the shrinking media and the shrinking reporting, but if you read the newspapers or just only take a kind of passing glance at the television news, you probably are led to believe that in Iraq and Afghanistan, there are really only two roads for American foreign policy. One is more fighting, more weapons, more kinetics. The other is exit from a region that's complicated and surpasses our understanding. What I love about higher education, what I love about the university, what I love about colleagues like these is that they allow you to see that there's a third and a fourth and fifth road, that there are other ways, that these are complex realities that we encounter, but with creative thinking, with thoughtful analysis, bringing our values and our principles to bear, there can be other ways that we can engage. And some of these roads, I think, call out more in us, call out the best in us. One of these roads was articulated in this Cairo speech that was mentioned by our panelists. And it was Barack Obama who said in Cairo, "I've come here to Cairo to seek a new beginning between the United States and Muslims around the world. One based on mutual interest and mutual respect, and one based upon the truth that America and Islam are not exclusive and need not be in competition. Instead, they overlap and share common principles, principles of justice and progress, tolerance, and the dignity of all human beings." And I think we here at Whitworth, no matter what our perspectives are, would share that aspiration and hope that other road might be a road that we would be called to follow, even though it would be a great deal more difficult than those simple approaches. So thank you, my colleagues, for the time that you've given, for the thought that you've given on a difficult issue. And thank you all for coming and engaging in this great conversation. Thanks.